Some of you will know that at the beginning of August, I spent a few days down in St. Albans with Simon, trying to get a lay of the land so that whenever September began, I could hit the ground running. Now, September is here, and I'm not sure that I'm quite running, more like walking slowly, but still, it was really helpful to have those few days. Without them, it probably would have been more like crawling at the moment. And one of the things that we obviously talked about was Sunday mornings, and we began to plan September's preaching rota. And we agreed that I should take this, my first Sunday morning, to set out something akin to my manifesto. That was how Simon put it. Though now that the time has arrived, I'm looking forward to a time that I can talk a little less about myself than these last few months have required. But I quickly settled on a couple of ideas on what passage I might preach on, as I think that there are two passages that God has given me as lenses through which I am to understand my calling and my ministry. The first is John 13, where Jesus washes his disciples' feet at the Last Supper. And the second is this passage in 1 Thessalonians, and in particular, verse 8. Because we loved you so much, we were delighted to share with you not only the gospel of God, but our whole lives as well. So as you now know, I settled on the 1 Thessalonians passage. However, a few days after making that decision, Simon sent me an email with the preaching rota attached. And under today's date, he gave a reading, which was the lectionary reading for today, which was Matthew 18, verses 15 to 20. Oh, I thought, well, I don't want to rock the boat too early on. I don't want to, you know, cause any hassle. So let's just check out that passage and see what it's about. It's only six verses. That's six whole verses less than mine to preach on. That might be quite nice. Well, in those six verses of Matthew, we find the following: how to go about church discipline, how decisions on earth loose and bind decisions in heaven, and also we have a promise that God will always do what we ask of him. Now, I know it was the lectionary reading and not Simon's deliberate choice, but come on, it was my first week, nothing like easing me in, and it certainly didn't look like an appealing manifesto. And we have all seen some pretty unappealing manifestos over the last year and a bit. So I decided to set my stall out early and ignore Simon and do the passage that I wanted to do, with his permission, of course. And as it turns out, I didn't completely ignore him, for the title that Simon had put with this passage was Life Together. And I thought that that was a very apt title for my manifesto, because it is exactly that idea of life together which I find so important, so powerful, and so challenging in this passage in Thessalonians. It is this idea of life together that God has put on my heart to shape my ministry. I will judge my ministry, and you can too, by how well it lives up to 1 Thessalonians 2, verse 8. Because we loved you so much, we were delighted to share with you not only the gospel of God, but our lives as well. That is my manifesto, that is my rallying cry, that is the verse that Becky and I will do our utmost to live amongst you. That is how I will try to be your minister. It is a promise to try and do life together. I have lived with this verse for many years because it belonged to another couple whose ministry deeply touched my life, who I was deeply blessed by. A couple without whom I can confidently say that I would not be here today. Their names were Paul and Val, and they were youth ministers at the church in the next town over, who I came to know and to love through many years serving together in the summer in the Czech Republic. This was their verse for ministry, and they lived and still live it out. They shared the gospel with me and with many others, revealing a God who loved me who had plans for me, who had gifted me, who showed me grace to practice those gifts, to make mistakes, to get better, to experience the joy and calling that God had placed on my life. But they did more than that. They shared their lives as well. They opened their home where I was always welcome, and we talked about music and movies and TV and life. They kept me in their hearts and allowed me to be part of their lives. They are dear friends, and I visit them as often as I can. I have seen what ministry can look like, enlivened by this verse, and I pray for God's grace to live it out. Will I be able to say that I have loved my congregation, both the core and those on the edge, so much that I have shared with you not only the gospel of God, but my whole life as well? Time will tell. I pray for God's equipping and his mercy. I pray for your patience and your energy. I pray that we will live life together. But let's put a little more meat on those bones. It's a nice verse and everything, but what does it mean for ministry? Well, we begin by seeing that Paul's driving mission, his primary motivation, is sharing the gospel of God. Paul tells us that it was because of his love for the Thessalonians that he shared his life with them, implicitly suggesting that whether he had liked them or not, he still would have shared the gospel with them. That was his task. That was what he had been approved to do. That was the gift he was entrusted with. That was his mission. And so it remains for us, for you and for me, the primary responsibility of all disciples and certainly of all ministers is to share the good news of God with all who God places in our care, which is pretty much everyone that we meet. Now, that might sound like a blindingly obvious thing to say, but the role of minister, the job of minister, has a great variety of tasks. Plenty of meetings, quite a few chance encounters, a good deal of administration, some vision casting, some planning, some moving chairs, maybe even cutting a garden or painting a bit, and on and on and on. And I need the reminder that I have been entrusted with the greatest gift of all, the gospel of God. And my primary responsibility, the reason for doing all of those things, is to share that gift. I wonder how you feel about that mission. I wonder what you think when you hear the phrase, sharing the gospel. I wonder if there's a few hearts that get excited, that beat a little faster. Realistically, I think maybe there's a few more of us thinking about the street preacher shouting, turn or burn. I wonder if anyone is picturing a tract, road to God. I wonder if someone has a picture of a bridge with us on one side and a big gap in the middle and God on the other. Maybe some fire in the gap in between, just waiting for that cross to come down into the middle. I wonder if any of you have broke out into a cold sweat, oh dear. He's going to ask us to do evangelism. Well, yes, absolutely. We have a gift we need to share. But I have some good news about the gospel. I have some good news about the good news. It is much, much bigger than all of those old evangelistic techniques. The gospel is far more than a transaction where we say sorry to God and get a ticket to heaven. The good news about the good news is that it is much bigger than that. The gospel of God is the proclamation that Jesus is King. Not me, not Trump, not Caesar, not you, not me. Jesus is King. He was there when it all began, creating this world of diversity and beauty. He was there forging us out of love, through love, for love, for a life of purpose and meaning. And he hasn't left us alone, but is involved in this world still, guiding it, leading it, nudging it towards wisdom and justice. He came as a human being to share this life with us, to suffer alongside us and for us, to show us that we aren't alone, and to show that a different way, that a different world is possible. And even as we killed him and said, "Get lost," he demonstrated that new way, crying out forgiveness, revealing a grace that defeats even death. Jesus Christ defeated death and hope was born. Hope for freedom from all those things that enslave us. Hope that our past won't completely determine our future. Hope that even death will not have the last word. And he continues to come to us, to be with us in our sufferings and our joys, speaking a new word, speaking redemption, speaking life, speaking resurrection. And when God speaks, worlds are created and everything changes. That is at least part of the gospel of God, and it is powerful, it is beautiful, it is earth-shattering and people-changing, and it is our gift to share through words and deeds with one another and this world. It is a gift that I am entrusted as minister with sharing. It is God's mission that we are invited into. Lord, give me eyes to see and ears to hear how your gospel is at work amongst us and in this area, and enable me to share it, enable us to share it, so that we all might become the people you have made us to be. If this is my calling, if this is our calling, then to do it, we need to follow Paul's example. We must keep our eyes fixed on God. We must remember that the gospel is not ours, but his. We must remember that we are only able to do it because God has called us, approved us, entrusted us, and equipped us. We must not give in to the temptation to allow the judgment of people, whether positive or negative, to decide what we do. For down that path leads impure motives, trickery, flattery, and greed. Instead, we must get our identity, we must learn our value from the God who loves us. And we must trust in his judgment alone. For God sees you and he knows you. He will judge you and he will forgive you. He will celebrate you. Our calling is to share the gospel of God, and my primary responsibility as your minister is to seek out where God is on the move, where he is working to bring about his kingdom, and to share that with you and all who I meet in word and deed. So far, so good. But what this passage, and verse 8 in particular, says to me is that my calling is actually for more than this. My calling is not just to share the gospel of God with you because it is my task, my job, it's what I get paid to do. My calling is to allow God to shape my heart, to love you enough that I want, that I need to share the gospel of God with you. For when that happens, I will share the gospel by sharing my whole life. This is what we see in the life of Jesus Christ. Not just a life of purpose and task, though it was certainly that, but a life of love and hospitality. Love must always drive our mission, our tasks, our purpose. If the gospel is to be more than a transaction, more than a spiel, more than a technique, it must be enlivened by love. The gospel is never to become a dusty book on the shelf to be brought down every so often when we feel like we haven't done any evangelism in a while. It is to become the Word of God made flesh and blood and living in our neighborhood. The gospel will be found in the midst of our joys and our heartache, the depression and the new job, the miscarriages and the first cry of an infant, the first day of school, the last day of life. God doesn't work in the abstract, but in the dirt and the blood and the sweat and the tears and the laughter of the life of his people. That is where he is to be found, and that is to be where he is to be shared and proclaimed and celebrated and lamented and all the grand variety of human emotions and expressions that he created us to enjoy and to live. The gospel of God ultimately is that God is love and that his kingdom is near. My calling is to live that out in your midst, to love you, to live near you, not just physically, but spiritually and emotionally, to know what is going on in your life and to let you into what is going on in mine, to know what mission God has placed on your heart and to do my best to encourage and equip you to do that, to know where you see God on the move so we can get together and join in, and to be there with you in those times where you will feel his absence. In those times of grief and in those times of doubt. And to be there with you as your heart breaks. This is the type of ministry that I see Paul reveal in this passage. And as he tries to explain it, as he tries to grapple with it, he reaches again and again for a family of analogies. The analogy of a family. He who was an apostle of Christ, with authority, entrusted with the gospel of God, became like a child, living humbly and gently amongst his flock, living joyously and unassumingly. He became their nursing mother, an incredibly striking feminine image for a male first century Jew to use. He fed them. He held them close to his heart. He nurtured them. He cared for them. They became his brothers and sisters on an equal footing as children of God, working together, not burdening them any more than he could avoid. He became a father to them, protecting, loving, encouraging, challenging them on. Sometimes we can overplay family language in church because some of us have less than ideal families and experience, and it can be difficult. It can be distancing. And some of us can sit in church sometimes and feel very alone, and it maybe doesn't feel like a family. But it's undeniable what Paul is doing here, and it's undeniable that I feel that this is my sense of calling, to love all who God places in my care, to share my life with you, to try and relate to you individually and differently as the situation and the season of life determines, to create a space of openness and vulnerability, of inclusion and acceptance, to create a family, to create a home, or at least give us the eyes to see the home that God is creating amongst us. A home that welcomes all waifs and strays, all the homeless, all the orphans, all the prodigals of this world. A home with an open door and a warm fire and some nice homemade soup from Cross Street. And look, I know I'm coming into a church that has 375 years of history, that has a long family of history, and that will continue undoubtedly long after I leave. I'm not naive enough to think that I'm doing anything revolutionary or new, as I set out here. But still, new can be overrated. This is my calling. This is what I feel God has asked me to do, to be. For only as this develops, and it won't happen overnight, it can't happen overnight, only then will I be able to see the good news of God in your life and the life of this church. Only then will I be able to see what has happened and what is to come. Only then will I be able to suggest where God might be taking us as individuals and collectively. Only then will the good news take on flesh and live amongst us. Only then will I be able to fulfill my calling to encourage, comfort, and urge us all to live lives worthy of God, who calls us into his kingdom and his glory. Only then will we be able to open our doors and welcome in all the long-lost family members looking for a home. Because we loved you so much, we were delighted to share with you not only the gospel of God, but our lives as well. In God's strength, I hope so.